First, I would like you to introduce yourself a little bit, and then we'll talk about the roles Human Rights Watch play in dealing with human rights issues around the world.
Yeah, so my name's Elaine Pearson. I'm the Australia Director of Human Rights Watch. I've been in this role for just over 3 years, and previously I was the Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch based in New York. I've done a lot of work on human trafficking over the years. Prior to working for Human Rights Watch, I also worked for the UN and Anti-Slavery International and several other organizations working on trafficking. And that work was really about putting the human rights of victims of trafficking at the center of any policies that governments were adopting to counter trafficking. But since I joined Human Rights Watch, the work has been quite a lot broader. The work that we do at Human Rights Watch is to investigate human rights abuses wherever they happen all over the world. So we have about 100 researchers on staff. People go out into the field, they conduct fact-finding investigations, they talk to victims of human rights abuses, they talk to witnesses, they talk to government officials. In some cases, we even talk to the perpetrators of human rights violations. And then we publish that information in reports. And these reports are very carefully vetted to make sure that everything in them is factually accurate. And then we publicize those reports. So usually when we release a report, we'll hold a press conference, and then we will also have open a discussion, a dialogue with the government in question, and sometimes with other influential governments as well, in order to raise our concerns that are mentioned in the report, but also our recommendations about what the government needs to do to address that particular human rights violation. On the subject of trafficking, we've done a number of reports. We've particularly looked at trafficking of domestic workers from countries in Asia to the Middle East or to other countries in Asia. So we've done a lot of reporting on Malaysia, Singapore. We've looked at issues such as slavery in the fishing sector in Thailand. We've looked at issues around the trafficking of Thai women for the sex trade to Japan. So a whole range of issues there. But we also look at broader issues such as political prisoners, freedom of expression, abuses during armed conflict, torture, enforced disappearances, extrajudicial killings. So it's quite a wide range of topics that we cover.
But from what you have mentioned, does Human Rights Watch has particular roles to influence or have any impact on the reports that you guys done research and published to the media or general organizations such as governments or UN or human rights organization or the NGO organization? Does it has any impact at all?
Yes, the reports do have a major impact. I mean, usually when we publish our reports, we get a lot of media coverage, so we get a lot of attention to the issue. And we often try and pick issues that we feel like haven't been covered in depth before, or where we feel that we can bring, you know, a new angle or a deeper investigation. So media pressure is important because I think it also forces the government to look at issues which sometimes they don't want to look at or they don't want to address. Maybe just to give one example of impact when it comes to issues of exploitation of migrant domestic workers, we did a report many years ago in Singapore where we documented the horrible conditions that migrant domestic workers, particularly from Indonesia and the Philippines, were subjected to in Singapore. The fact that they often didn't have a day off, that they had to pay exorbitant sums back to the recruitment agencies that hired them. It was very difficult for them to change jobs, even if they were being abused by their employers. And in the worst cases, there was sexual and physical abuse. As a result of that report, Singapore actually changed its laws and policies on domestic workers by implementing a standard contract and by ensuring that domestic workers at least get a regular day off. So absolutely our reports do have an impact, but often it's quite slow going. It takes quite a bit of time, and it's also the partnership that we have with local organisations who are working on the ground. And also with journalists and with others who are interested in making progress on these issues.
According to the UNODC, organization that responsible for human trafficking in person, reports to say that the victim who were trafficked by the traffickers are still the only person that is responsible for rescuing themselves. And even though governments around the world, they have legislation or legal to protect the people, there is a little intention to deal with this problem. Is that so, or is that the case?
Well, yes, that's true. I mean, I also sit on the board of an organization called the Global Alliance Against Trafficking Women, which is based in Bangkok. And with that organization, we've certainly focused on the importance of not just getting laws passed to counter trafficking, which I think a lot of governments have done, particularly since the International Treaty on Trafficking was opened for signature back in, I think it was 2000, the Anti-Trafficking Protocol. So we've seen a lot of progress in terms of anti-trafficking legislation, but we've seen very little, we've seen poor or patchy, I would say, implementation of those laws. And I think part of the problem is that, you know, if you really want to prevent and deter trafficking, you also need to address the root causes of why people are taking such risks to migrate. And the reason why they're often doing that is because there's no safe legal alternatives for people to migrate. So I think that that's actually a really key important thing that governments need to do, is to provide safe legal alternative pathways for migration, as well as providing information to migrants who, you know, potentially may be trafficked about what their rights are in destination countries. Because otherwise what happens is that victims, you know, are duped into going somewhere, they turn up, the job is not what they've been promised, but they don't know how to get out of it. And sometimes they come from countries where they, you know, they don't have any faith in the police because the police are corrupt, and sometimes police can even be involved in the trafficking of people. And so they're unwilling to go to the police, to run away, and because they're scared that they're going to be locked up. Mm-hmm. And they're also worried often about the debts that they have to pay off traffickers. Okay. So I think it's really important that at every point of the journey, that information is made available to people to let them know what are their rights in the destination country and who are the organisations who may be able to assist them, particularly if there are hotlines that are available in migrant languages.
Do you want to take us through the new human rights report which has been released recently?
Yes. So last week we released the Human Rights Watch World Report. This is a global report. It includes chapters on some 90 countries around the world. It includes a chapter on Australia for the fourth year, as well as many countries around Asia. The theme of the global report this year was really looking at the rise of populist authoritarian leaders in Europe, and now, unfortunately, in the US with the election of Trump. And these are leaders who all, you know, they all have something in common, I guess, that is an open contempt for human rights. And they make a lot of statements about committing human rights violations, which, you know, unfortunately has been, you know, some of these statements politically have resonated with certain parts of communities. And I think for us, this represents a really dangerous threat to human rights and to our values. And it's very dangerous to go down this path of scapegoating, whether it's foreigners, whether it's refugees, whether it's migrants, whether it's Muslim communities, for the problems that the world is facing. And so a lot of these demagogues tend to present oversimplistic solutions to things, which, you know, in reality won't really work. So I think the challenge for all of us is really to reassert the need for remembering why we have the human rights system in place. And, you know, I think World War II might be a distant memory for some people, but I think you only have to think back to World War II and the reason why we set up the human rights conventions and the system under the United Nations. And that was because governments, if they're not constrained, and if they choose to act just simply according to what they perceive as the will of the majority, then that creates, you know, certainly a realm where horrific atrocities can occur. And we certainly don't want to see the world going down that path again. I guess maybe just to bring it back to Australia, the Australian chapter of the report focused on primarily the refugee issue, and that is because, you know, now those who are detained on Manus and Nauru, about 2,000 people, will be coming into, for many of them, the fourth year of detention. And despite repeated reports by the UN, by human rights groups, urging Australia to take action on this, we haven't seen any real action to remove people from an environment that quite clearly is harmful and causing long-term devastating consequences for their mental health. So for Australia, I think the priority really needs to be getting people off Manus and Nauru. And unfortunately, it now looks like the agreement with the US, you know, may really be in doubt, because the new president coming into the US has been very anti-migration.
You also mentioned what happened in Europe and in America, but a lot of complex things also happened in Africa and in Asia as well. Yes.
Yeah, and I should say, I mean, the rise in these types of leaders are not confined, you know, purely to Europe and the United States. I mean, in Asia, we in the last year, obviously, President Duterte in the Philippines has openly said that, you know, human rights aren't important. He's waged a campaign in which thousands of people accused of drug crimes have been executed and killed. And this is really dangerous. I mean, we have other countries also like Thailand where, you know, the military has taken control, and a country that was, you know, once a, quite a stable path towards democracy, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the basic rights of democracy have been suspended in Thailand. Yeah, well, with Thailand, I mean, as I said, I think we've seen a lot of repression since the military junta took power over the last year or so. We know that Thai authorities arrested at least, well, more than 100 politicians, activists, journalists, and supporters of political movements, particularly those who had criticised the proposed constitution and said that they would vote no. So we're particularly concerned, I guess, about the direction in Thailand, and that the space for free speech really seems to have shrunk considerably. We also know in Thailand that people are being prosecuted for comments that they make online under the Draconian Computer Crimes Act, as well as several provisions of the Penal Code. When it comes to Laos, we unfortunately didn't include a chapter on Laos in our World Report, largely because we just don't have the resources. We don't have a full-time Laos researcher, so it's a little bit difficult for us to monitor everything there. Mm-hmm. But we do know that, you know, we're still concerned about the enforced disappearance of a Laos activist several years ago, despite compelling evidence showing that security forces were involved. There's been no progress in that investigation. And, you know, this really is something that is quite chilling for other activists who are working in Laos, that if they speak up, if they criticise the government in any way, that they too, you know, may effectively wind up disappeared. And in Indonesia, you know, I think we've certainly seen the rise of religious extremists and, you know, those who have been emboldened maybe by the government's lack of action in their agitation against religious minorities, and now they're choosing bigger and bigger targets. And so you've seen, you know, these massive demonstrations against the governor of Jakarta, against Ahok, under a law that, you know, really by Indonesia's constitution, it respects religious freedom. And so we certainly don't think that, you know, the comments that he made are something that justify such a strong response. In Africa, I mean, I think what we've seen is quite a number of leaders have removed or extended term limits in order to stay in office. Other leaders have used violent crackdowns to suppress protests over unfair elections. And we also know that, you know, several African leaders who feel vulnerable to prosecution have harshly criticised the International Criminal Court, and three countries have announced their withdrawal. So, you know, also a pretty negative picture appearing from Africa also.
Is there anything has been done after Kofi Annan has visited Myanmar to deal with the Rohingya Muslim people?
Yes, I mean, when it comes to Burma, Myanmar, unfortunately, we've seen a bit of a resurgence of violence incidences towards the end of the year. We've seen, and I think this is really the result of a protracted situation in the Rakhine State, where Muslims, particularly the Rohingya, have been held in camps. They have a lot of restrictions on freedom of movement. It's very difficult for them to work. And, you know, what we've seen is we've seen a very heavy-handed response to the killings of several police in Rakhine State. And we have been able to document by satellite imagery entire buildings and some villages being burnt. I think at least 1,500 buildings in Rakhine State that have been burnt down. So we know that Kofi Annan visited Rakhine State recently. However, the government's interim report really doesn't give us a lot of faith that the government is doing a serious, credible investigation into these abuses. They need to allow unfettered access to journalists and human rights investigators to see what actually happened on the ground, and that hasn't happened.
But Aung San Suu Kyi also have an indication that international community, such as UN or human rights or whoever, should jump in and help Myanmar solve its problem. Is that the case? Should it let Myanmar run its course?
Well, I think if the government was allowing journalists to go and investigate, I mean, you know, we would love to see Myanmar journalists and Myanmar human rights organisations go and investigate what's happening on the ground, but the reality is it's completely closed, those areas of northern Rakhine State. They've had a chaperone tour for a bunch of journalists. I do understand that the UN Special Rapporteur recently visited some of the areas in Rakhine, which is positive. But really, I think when, you know, these types of allegations of abuses surface, the correct response, rather than simply trying to discredit the activists who are raising these questions, is to say, we will do an investigation, we'll look at what's happening, and we'll also open up access to allow journalists to see and to talk to people in order to determine what actually transpired. Also in China, under President Xi Jinping, we've seen real increased repression and crackdown on basic civil liberties in China. Just as one example, in Tibet recently, someone who was a shopkeeper who has openly and publicly advocated for the importance of education in Tibetan language is now facing charges of inciting separatism, and he faces a 15-year prison sentence. Now, there are numerous cases like that all across China, of activists, lawyers, people who have spoken up and criticized the government in really, you know, often quite, you know, very soft ways. This wasn't someone who had openly advocated Tibetan separatism at all, had said that, you know, it was important for Tibet to remain as a part of China, and yet he's still being imprisoned for some remarks that he made about education. So this is a really dangerous trend that we've noticed in China, and we are concerned that particularly with the election of Trump, who has really talked about his rejection of human rights values, which for better or for worse, you know, have been quite an important part of the US's foreign policy, we're concerned about the knock-on effects this may have, particularly in Southeast Asian countries, where authoritarian leaders may feel like they're getting a bit of a green light to commit abuses because the US simply isn't raising concerns as forcefully as it does in the past.
So is there any way out for all these human rights issues around the globe?
I think the way out, it might seem like it's a very depressing situation when you look at all the human rights problems around the globe. But what this really needs is an affirmation and a defence of basic human rights values. And I think it's really important that this comes not only from human rights organisations. We need to build more alliances with other civil society groups across different sectors in society. And we need to stand up for human rights values. But journalists also have a role to play. I think it's very important that journalists don't just follow the news of the day, the latest scandal or things, you know, excessive things that certain presidents have said. I think it's really important that they do the sort of longer lasting analysis of the impact of, you know, these human rights violations. And ultimately, I think the responsibility really lies with the public. The best way of addressing these issues is for voters to demand a politics based on truth and the values on which a rights-respecting democracy is built. And so, you know, I think a strong popular reaction, particularly in upcoming elections around the world, is probably the best defence to maintain our core human rights values.